Welcome to Catherine Flynn's podcast, Intelligent Edge Yoga, conversations for smart, compassionate practice. Each episode will guide and inquire into ethics-based spirituality within a modern paradigm of practice. Whether your practice is yoga, Ayurveda, meditation, or simply living a life full of intention, this is for you. I'd like you to take a moment to consider supporting this podcast through Patreon. Your pledges enable the continuation of the podcast. Patrons will also receive exclusive resources, behind-the-scenes material for instructors, guided yoga and meditation sessions for yogis, and everything in between. This is just the start of something new and exciting. You can be a part of it by going to patreon.com/intelligentedgeyoga and clicking on the large orange button. Thanks.
Welcome to Intelligent Edge Yoga, yoga conversations for smart, compassionate practice with Catherine Ann Flynn. I'm Catherine. Hi, podcast listeners. If you're an average yoga student, you attend classes at studios or gyms or your place of work, you probably haven't given too much thought as to whether yoga is regulated or not. And generally speaking, it's not. Yoga classes aren't. Which is why you can tack pretty much anything onto yoga and still call it yoga, be it goats or primal scream therapy. While yoga students are a large part of the yoga community, there are other key figures that shape the landscape. Teachers, studio owners, yoga educators or teacher trainers, and the Yoga Alliance. Yoga education is the most regulated of all activities because no other aspect of the industry has the same amount of financial influence. Yoga trainings help keep studios open and are seen as the only way to make a viable career of teaching yoga. Being so financially influential and shaping the culture of the yoga community, trainings have the most reason to be regulated, but they're not really regulated. What you may think of as a yoga regulator is typically a registry or an association. In Britain, there's the British Wheel of Yoga, founded in 1965. If you visit the top of their website, there's a large button that says join, but you have to scroll to the bottom of the page, click on About Us, and get four paragraphs into that section to find out they are a self-described yoga membership organization. The Yoga Alliance of the United States says that they're international and they are a nonprofit association that does not regulate yoga, but instead they foster and cultivate high-quality, safe, and accessible yoga, which brings us to our conversation. Today, I'm joined by Daniel Clement, who's been teaching yoga since 1997, running yoga trainings and workshops and offering the tools of yoga in a secular way. Daniel joins us from the West Coast in British Columbia. Bree Johnson has been teaching yoga and applied anatomy since 2003. As the founder of Heart and Bones Yoga, she runs a popular online yoga studio with a focus on sustainable approaches to yoga, mentorship, and community building. Bree teaches workshops and teacher trainings internationally and is known for her accessible integration of movement education. Mona Warner is an Ayurvedic practitioner, Ayurvedic yoga therapist, studio owner, and yoga educator in Kingston, Ontario. She has published two books on Ayurveda, offered over 30 yoga teacher training programs, and recently published a workbook on Ayurveda for grief. Let's begin.
Welcome, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
We're going to dive right in. I touched on a few things that I imagine will come up, but I'm going to turn it over to all of you. What are your thoughts on regulating yoga, the phrase, the process, and what aspects of the yoga experience do you feel should be regulated? We're going to start with Mona.
That's a huge question. As I was preparing, I was thinking about that question so much all day. And it's interesting because I think in terms of yoga regulation, it depends how you define yoga. It depends on how you define yoga. And so if you define yoga in its, I hesitate to use this, but I'll say in its more original context as a spiritual practice, then how do you regulate a spiritual practice? And if what we're referring to is the practice of asana or of physical postures and a lot of the more movement-like activities, then given that so many other movement-like activities in our world are regulated in some capacity. And so we know there's a process, there's a curve. People who don't have experience don't teach these things. Well, and we hope people without experience don't teach these things, fingers crossed. And so it's a really tough question to answer because it really depends on how you define yoga. And I believe this has been the challenge in the industry so far is people see yoga in so many different ways. And based on that, have a lot of different perspectives on whether it should be regulated or not, who should have a say in its regulation or not, and then how to go about doing it. It's really hard to regulate a spiritual practice. It's really hard to regulate somebody's personal experience of themselves as a spirit or as a soul having a human experience. How do you even begin to govern that in any way, shape, or form? So I think it's a really, really tough proposition. I think it's a challenging proposition. And I also believe that if we want to be seen as an industry and as a profession, so if those of us who are yoga educators and those of us who participate in this very multifaceted exploration of self, I don't know any other professions that are recognized that don't have some sort of regulation, guideline, ethics committee, all of that sort of stuff to come with it. And I think if everyone who played in Yoga Land had the utmost of integrity, I don't know that we'd have to worry about it. And the reality is that we do have to worry about it because all sorts of weird shit has been happening and is happening. And it's causing risk of injury to the people who are playing and participating in Yoga Land. And so I don't have any big answers. I simply am aware that it is a big yoga land is very big. And it's almost like within the theme park, there's all these different, like when you go to MGM and you've got like the Alfred Hitchcock part and you've got the Back to the Future part and you've got the earthquake land and Dinosaurville, right? So we have Yoga Land, the amusement park, and then we have all these different bits within it. And yet I do believe that within all of that yoga, there's some sort of common thread in there, and that with the common thread of where yoga, so like the Venn diagram of yoga, where all the pieces overlap, I think there's that piece that's really important. And I think the way that we share practice with others who are new or experienced within the practice, it might be worth looking at how we're able to come together and do that while honoring all the different areas of Yoga Land, and yet also finding ways to keep those who are coming into Yoga Land to explore safe and loved. Those are my initial thoughts.
That's a great start. And the last 6 months of my life have definitely been Dinosaurville yoga at home with a 3-year-old. But I'm going to turn it over to Bree.
Hey, yeah, as Mona, that was beautiful. I loved your metaphor of Yoga Land as a theme park. I think that's a really fun way to acknowledge the fact that there's a lot of different approaches to yoga and styles and teachers and needs and desires and outcomes. And I think in a lot of ways, that's also why maybe it hasn't been regulated. It is an interesting question to unpack, and maybe not the question to unpack in this conversation today, but as to why hasn't it been regulated? You know, obviously Yoga Alliance has, Yoga Alliance has maybe given the impression that they're regulating it. And I answer a lot of emails from people being like, oh, are you as a teacher trainer? Oh, is your course Yoga Alliance? And I say, well, first of all, it's a registry. So they've done a great job of giving me a perception that there's governance, and there's not. And so that's a huge can of worms. And so some of the things that I just want to try to touch on here is, at the very least, within Yoga Land, the through line is maybe like, at least let's get a cohesive scope of practice as a teacher teaching this. Maybe within that scope of practice, what needs to happen is, okay, if we're teaching yoga asana, no matter what your tradition and maybe no matter what your style, if we're teaching bodies to move in a certain way, there needs to be a scope of practice. There needs to be some regulation there. And then the spirit part, as you say, Mona, so wonderfully, exactly, we can't control that, and nor should we try to regulate that. And I think a lot of people come to yoga to not have that sort of more organized religion feeling around a spiritual practice. But nonetheless, teaching bodies to move is very specific, and we need adequate and foundational approaches to yoga and how we teach that to teachers teaching other bodies to move. And yeah, so I think scope of practice would be a really beautiful through line that at the very least, can we do that? And maybe that's the foundation. And then from that strong foundation, us as yoga asana teachers, then we can agree, okay, the shoulder joint needs to move in a certain way. This is how we're going to teach it. The hip joints, like, you can't argue with that. You can't argue with biomechanics and science. And then that foundation gets built and freedom from there. That would be my two cents on that. Then I would even, without opening up this other can of worms, like, who gets to do the regulation? Who do we decide get to be our governing bodies? Like, I think this, anyways, I don't even want to go there. That makes my head spin. And then we've got the commodification too. So whose interests are behind regulating it and not regulating it? And it's these are such big questions. And I love that we're having this conversation and nothing's going to get solved, but I think it's really good we're talking about all of this. So yeah, so my big thing would be scope of practice. How can we at least have an agreed upon thing in terms of movement and then go from there?
Well, thanks, Bree. Turning you over to Daniel.
Thanks, Catherine. And thanks everyone for your comments so far. I think you've picked people who are probably all on the same page. It sounds like we all have a sense of humor about this, and we're also sounds like pretty pragmatic. And I throw my hat in the same ring with that. I think regulating yoga, the first thing you would have to do is define it. And of course, that's always been the biggest problem because it has such a broad definition. But in order, you know, for most people's experience of yoga practice, we're really talking about the physical practice of yoga. It may be a little bit of breath work, but primarily they're on a mat. And that's what I think you could build some limitations and some best practices around. And like Bree was mentioning, anatomy and biomechanics, I mean, those things are, you know, you can argue a little bit about what the best way to do triangle is, but there's definitely better and worse ways. There's ways that would hurt you maybe, and there's ways that would maximize your potential as a student. And they can be discovered. You know, we have slightly different anatomy, but we have a lot of similarities from human to human. So I would tend to, if it were me, if it was, you know, to sort of build the ship that's going to sail into this new territory, I would definitely, the first thing I would do is define the physical part of yoga as the thing that would be regulated. And as I think it was Mona was saying, you know, that you can't really regulate what somebody steps into in terms of their philosophy about afterlife or spirituality, whatever you want to call it. Those things, I don't even think you really need to touch so much in terms of teaching physical yoga, though they have been married together in a lot of ways as a kind of a value-added system. It's not, you know, quote, just exercise. And I think that's had some problems too, because it tends to diminish just exercise as something that's not spiritual. So there's sort of epistemologically a lot of problems there to cover. But I think if we could talk about the physical practice of yoga as being something that could be understood to be, you know, better and worse in terms of how it's done, and then from there, you could maybe get some agreement, even from people from different schools of yoga, different backgrounds, as to what a best practice would be. So I think, yeah, for me, it would be narrowing the definition to something that could actually be understood and regulated. So that's where I see it. Yeah.
What's coming out largely is minimizing risk. But I think that also raises the question that, like, where is the risk? Because something I'm very passionate about in my trainings and conveying in my trainings is that most people with, you know, with the right intention, with an attitude of thoughtfulness, and with some yoga experience under their belt, they have the skills after a good teacher training to go lead some lunchtime yoga. They do. I personally think they do. Where they don't get too rulesy. I actually think that sometimes the insistence on a certain performance of asana is actually where we get a little bit risky. But that being said, this is all about minimizing risk. So before we talk about how Yoga Alliance does or does not regulate yoga, does anyone want to respond to that or to each other about minimizing risk? Bree and then Mona.
Okay, I love that. Yeah, exactly. What a great simplified way to say that is minimizing risk. And in my experience teaching both yoga, asana, and applied anatomy, and then bringing applied anatomy to integrate within yoga asana, the way as a teacher, the pedagogy in which I teach is that I found helpful. So this is what I'll share is when we can break it down to minimize risk, it's not about teaching alignment rules per yoga pose. It's actually giving people a really solid foundation of what I call the movement ABCs. So what does that shoulder joint need? What does the hip joint need? What's active and passive stretches? What are, you know, like what are the ranges of motion? All these really simplified things once you know them. And then when you know those foundations, those ABCs, then you can put them together really skillfully and quite easily actually into yoga asana without it being dogmatic and without it being this prescription. Because if somehow somebody was listening to this and created some magical new yoga alliance and was like, here's a scope of practice for movement and now creating more rules on that. No, it's more just learn like this basic foundation of movement education that in my experience, these building blocks just can be applied into movement in everyday life. And it's simple and it rides a really beautiful line between knowledge and a framework, but not going into dogma territory. Like these are the five cues you have to say for Trikonasana. Cause we hopefully all know that by this point, that's old now.
You know? Oh, no, between two planes of glass.
Two planes of glass, exactly. Your pelvis, flatten it. And like, and then I love it because what we do is we create very empowered yoga teachers. We create people who are learning to think for themselves from a solid base of understanding. And then hopefully they're transmitting that to their students and then giving more freedom and permission to people teaching to move in a way that's right for them rather than dogma. So that's what I have to say in my experience.
Okay. Just quickly. What I've noticed over the years, I totally agree with what you're saying. And when I hear yoga teachers who are practitioners talk, we sound this way. It's like, it seems such a simple thing to just be a self-learner and then understand the principles behind good movement and then just figure stuff out for yourself. But it always seems to be a rather constrained demographic that's actually able to do that. Not that people don't have the capacity, but often they don't have the time or the interest. Mm-hmm. That's why we end up with these sort of quick rules and heuristics. And so I think sometimes mapping our experience of yoga onto the general public is not always a perfect fit. That's just what I wanted to say.
I love that. I love that we laughed about doing triangle between two panes of glass. I wanted to say that first. I think that after 200-hour teacher training, the average teacher trainee is ready to teach somebody with some experience and who's fairly healthy in their body. And I think where some of the trouble arises, so I got an email from a graduate of one of our 200-hour teacher trainings, and she said, you know, the Interval House, which is a place here in Kingston that works with basically they shelter women and children who are trying to escape abusive family dynamics. And so she said, you know, a great opportunity for somebody in training would be to go volunteer at the Interval House. And I said, thank you so much for letting me know. And I'll be sending this to all the experienced teachers because working with people with trauma is not really an introductory thing. And so the reason I bring this up is, again, what is yoga? And so many folks, yes, yoga asana is a movement practice. It's an incredibly important aspect of the practice, and it allows us to move towards enlightenment through the vehicle of the body if that's what we want. And yet, so many people recognize the inherent capacity of yoga to be a healing modality that I think they confuse yoga with yoga therapy. So the application of yoga tools and techniques for specific therapeutic purposes, which is a whole other let's use the hours, because we're going to be playing in hours in this conversation anyways, a whole other 800 hours on top of a 200 hour training, right? So if somebody's doing a yoga therapy certification, you're looking at 850 to 1,000 hours of training. And this is the place where I think it gets confusing, because it's yoga therapy is still yoga, and yet it's kind of a different, it's not a different yoga. The application of the yoga is different than we do in a regular group public asana class than a yoga therapist might work with. And I've noticed that a lot of folks are very confused about all the different pieces in all the different parks in yoga land, right? So they didn't know that yoga therapy is actually this separate thing, and that working with vulnerable populations maybe requires more skills and different skills, not only an understanding of biomechanics and their application in asana, but now we're almost moving into psychology, and we're moving into sociology, and we're moving into, you know, a much bigger role of the heart-mind field realm than if we were talking a fundamental or a basic asana practice for a group of fairly healthy people who want to move their bodies at lunch. So I feel like that's another piece of it.
Oh. Can I jump in on that, Mona? I love that. So I think just to bring it back to that whole yoga alliance and regulation, I think what you're so beautifully showing and illustrating is that's why having, if we did have guidelines in the yoga world, like what are the scope of, that's within the scope of practice, right? It's like, so I think you just illustrated that so lovely. And in terms of that's where I would vote yes on some regulation. I would vote no in other places, but vote yes in that one.
Yeah. So just for listeners, I don't want to give the impression that yoga therapy is a regulated field and yoga is not. Yoga therapy is also not a regulated field. It's the International Association of Yoga Therapists. They are also a registry, not a regulator. And the term yoga therapist is unregulated, pretty sure in both Canada and the United States. Although I believe a couple of states might provide insurance dollars for yoga therapy, but I haven't heard of anything like that up here in Canada. Okay, so just putting that out there, because as I think Bree is about to talk about, the yoga industry and the yoga therapy industry thrives on perceptions. We've talked generally about regulating yoga. You've heard the term Yoga Alliance, and I'm curious to know the experiences of my guests, because just for dear listeners, just so you know, I actually don't know everybody's experience with Yoga Alliance. So we're going to start with Bree. What's your experience with Yoga Alliance, both as a teacher and a teacher trainer?
Well, I've never once been part of Yoga Alliance. So like we said at the beginning, I've been teaching since 2003, and I think that was before Yoga Alliance was even a thing. And or maybe it just started. I don't know. I don't quite remember. I do have a vague memory of thinking maybe it was starting and I was like, oh, maybe I should do this. And then me kind of being the lazy person that I am just didn't. So there's that. And then I started going. So I think I came into the yoga world at an early enough time. There weren't that many yoga teachers at the time, especially here in Canada. And it just kind of got us like swept in that way. But then over the years, once I started teaching and teaching teachers, like doing teacher trainings, I've done both teacher trainings that are Yoga Alliance approved and Yoga Alliance not, I don't want to say not approved, because that's, because that would mean they have power over us and what we do. But but I was able to be one of the teachers in a teacher training because we played the game a little bit. We thought, hey, shoot, we need to do this as a Yoga Alliance, right? Because this is one of my personal beefs about Yoga Alliance is the fact that it has this perception of governing body. And a lot of yoga teachers to be think that they needed to do a yoga course that's Yoga Alliance, and that's not wrong-ish. And so many years ago when we did this one course, actually a couple of course, two different trainings, main teachers, not myself, because I've never been Yoga Alliance registered. I've never wanted to be. I didn't want to go through the rigmarole. And so they became the lead teacher, even though we were the lead teachers in that sense. So it could still be a Yoga Alliance certified course. Did it do anything? Did we get more people in the end? Who knows? I found as we were sending the information to Yoga Alliance, I found their scope of practice very limiting. And in subsequent years, running my own teacher trainings that are not Yoga Alliance, proudly, in my opinion, not Yoga Alliance associated. It's because what I, you know, I've been teaching long enough and teaching teachers long enough that I have a pretty good idea of what we need to be successful yoga teachers. And I have a pretty good idea that, like, where, let's ask the question, where did 200 hours come from? Where did that number, 203? Oh, do you have an answer for that, Catherine?
I can answer that question. Leslie Kaminoff. if you listen to the interview I did with Leslie on this podcast, he talks about the creation of Yoga Alliance, which was 20 years ago. And he and a pile of other teachers were sitting around, mostly Americans, which we'll get to. And he basically tallied up the hours for the training that he did up here in Quebec. He talks in this interview about basically tallying the numbers on a napkin and being like, here you go.
Well, thank you for that. Oh my God, can we spread that wide and far? Like, it wasn't some magical, you know, like serious governing board that's like, you know, the best way to start the foundation. So, but granted, you know, at the same time, there had to be a minimum number. So there it is. So now this becomes the standards for that reason, some reason, right or wrong, good or bad, that's the industry standard. And so again, I'm a teacher who's very focused on pedagogy and what I'm teaching, how I'm teaching, and how people are learning it and ingesting that information and bringing the big picture, both of anatomy and the spiritual practice of yoga, which are really, that's a lifelong practice. It's a lifelong lifetimes to narrow it down into this funnel for people to learn in a way that's applicable to them as the teacher. And then how do they transmit it to students in classes that don't care as much as we do as yoga teachers? You know, like they don't care to the depth necessarily that we do, the people in the classes, the general population. So then how do we then be able to transmit this information to that? So all of that to say for me is that the scope of practice that Yoga Alliance offers, the 200 and the 300 at level, is not enough. The stuff that I, in my experience, feel is important takes more precedent to some of the other outlines that they have. So for me, I'm very proudly, because it's like quality over quantity of education. I don't want to try to change my course. And this is what my experience in those other courses that were Yoga Alliance approved. We had to shift and adapt to fit into their standards. And I felt limited. And in fact, the irony was there was no yoga police from the Yoga Alliance anyways, checking us to see if we actually taught what we submitted. So then there's that.
Daniel, what's your experience with Yoga Alliance? And
yeah, well, I've run about a little over 100 trainings, and they've all been Yoga Alliance registered. And I agree that 200 hour standards are arbitrary. And I've never really worried too much about the length. They could be longer or shorter. I think, you know, over the iterations of trainings, I've just carved out what I thought was essential that could fit into those hours. And if it was less hours or more hours, I probably would have done the same thing. So I don't have too much of a problem with the duration. As everyone has said here, they're not really a governing body. They're just sort of a registration body. There's no oversight. There's nobody looking inside the contents of each of those categories of training to figure out whether they're actually important to that training. And again, that comes back to our initial question: is how do you define yoga? Because with no definition of the thing that you're teaching, it's very difficult to parse it up and then try to make decisions about what each one of those slices, whether it's valuable or not. So there's a essential problem with the definition of yoga and then with Yoga Alliance categories. But having said that, my experience with them, I mean, they're very hands-off, as you guys all know. So I kind of appreciate that, because I don't want to have to conform to a lot of things. And it's given me the latitude to really play around with the trainings and put what I want to have in there. But I agree that they really don't hold much of a function for us. And there is just this perception that they are the ones that you want to register with. And I think a lot of students actually are looking for the 200 hour or the 300 hour trainings that are registered with Yoga Alliance. They feel that that certificate has value and meaning to them. So I do think, even though, like, just as for purposes of utility, that's helped me financially to be registered with them. Broadly, I don't think it really makes any difference. I would be happy to teach trainings without them being registered with Yoga Alliance. And maybe we can just interject this as we go forward now with COVID and the massive sea change that's happened in yoga and moving things online. I think the role of Yoga Alliance is going to be even more diminished, or will start to become more diminished, as people ask things like, why do I need a 200-hour training? There's no studios to teach in. If I can teach on Zoom, do I need insurance? These kinds of questions, right? So that's sort of where I stand with them.
Thanks, Daniel. Mona.
So I joined the Yoga Alliance shortly after I graduated my 200-hour teacher training in 2004. So they were fairly new. The training that I took was Yoga Alliance registered. And so I thought that was what you were supposed to do, right? You know how you sometimes are in a position where you don't know what you don't know, or you know just enough to get into trouble, but not enough to get back out. It's like doshas in Ayurveda. Everybody does a quiz and they know just enough to get themselves into trouble and never enough to get themselves back out of the hole. So when I finished my 200-hour teacher training, I registered with Yoga Alliance because I thought that's what you were supposed to do. And I found actually at the time, I never ended up teaching at a studio until about 10 or so years into teaching. And so I was teaching in office buildings and I was teaching all these sort of very independent contractory types of things. And at the time, because I was flying so solo and I was so new, I actually found the Yoga Alliance felt supportive to me. It felt supportive that there were, and I had this contact, her name was Jacqueline Gray, and I could call Jacqueline anytime and she always answered the phone and called me back. And so because I actually had a voice, a face, an energy, a personality to connect with at that time, I felt a connection and I felt like it was really supportive for me as a new teacher. And then as I transitioned into developing teacher training programs and moving in that direction, Jacqueline was incredibly helpful for that as well. One of the things I think can be really challenging in the modern context of yoga is traditionally there was a lot of emphasis on the student-teacher relationships, and students had the support of their teachers, I think, for a long, long time. And one of the things that I notice modern day is it's a lot of, come, take the training, check you later, good luck, I hope you do well, go change the world and shine your light. Like there's this almost loss of connection sometimes. And it can actually, as a student, because I may be a teacher and a teacher trainer, but I'm also a student of yoga, I'm blessed to actually have been able to find and maintain connection with some of my teachers, that it's not just this catch and release. Here we go, I caught you, I taught you something, go, right, off you go. And I feel like those, and I have the same in my Ayurveda land, where I have a few teachers that I have a strong connection with, so that when I get into trouble, I have somebody that I can actually go to and connect with to help me. And when I first started teaching yoga, though, it was this catch release feel. And so I actually felt somewhat caught and held by the Yoga Alliance. And that was really useful for me for a time. And then as time has passed and as I've offered more, you know, been doing teacher trainings for however long I've been doing them and been teaching students and open a studio and, you know, all these different things, it's kind of evolved a little bit where I feel like what's important to me and what I value in the teaching and in the relationship with my students and in how I want to teach and facilitate the teacher trainings, it's not always lining up with what Yoga Alliance is saying we should do. And that's okay. It just means it's not working for me as much anymore. And so I'm in a process of letting that go at this point, because I don't want to, integrity is really important to me, and alignment with the things I value is very important to me. And so I feel sometimes we have to let go of the things that don't really work as well anymore. And there are, for sure, as I've been sharing with my students, you know, I plan to continue teaching, I plan to continue offering all the exact same programs, always with their slight evolution as we learn as we go and new information becomes available and we adjust. I plan to offer the exact same programs. They just won't have the Yoga Alliance logo on the manual anymore. And the certificate won't have the Yoga Alliance logo on it anymore. A lot of my students have said, you know, I'm here to be with you. I'm not here to be with the Yoga Alliance through you. Although I have had a few students I had one student who said, oh, so if you're not with the Yoga Alliance, then you can't offer teacher trainings anymore. And I said, oh no, teacher trainings were offered for, like, people trained yoga teachers for a long time before the Yoga Alliance came into existence in 2000, you know, and it will continue. And I think the thing for me is the registry or the registration is not at all indicative of quality. It has nothing to do with that. And that's okay. Maybe that's not what they, what the Yoga Alliance wants to pursue. Because much like our first question, where we're like, how do you regulate yoga? I don't know. How do you regulate yoga? I can see how they might not want to open that can of worms. I also have experienced some of the limitations of the standards in terms of what I think will actually work for the folks who are training with me, what works for me as a trainer, and what I believe is important in terms of the content. The formats of the offerings, like we've been allowed to offer some things online because there's a pandemic. But before that, I don't know how many phone calls and how many emails I sent that went unresponded to about the integration and addition of online content, because there are some things that can actually be incredibly well delivered online, even pre-recorded, so that the students can hear that lecture 700 times if that's what it takes to remember the content, to go through the practices. And so I also have to say, I have a background in technology. Before I became a yoga teacher, I was a computer nerd. And so I've wanted to use technology far more than has been within the parameters. And then there's the whole piece of, again, people sort of feeling like they want that, but it doesn't quite fit. So the little games that get played to try to fit a mold that's not our mold. And I think that's the part that hurts my heart the most, is that people in this, in yoga land, feel like they have to play games in the industry of yoga in order for things to unfold. So whether it's like, oh, well, so-and-so, they did a training, but it wasn't Yoga Alliance, but I know they're a good teacher. So how do we get them a Yoga Alliance certificate? Or the hours don't quite work, but does it really matter in the overall? And nobody's looking anyways. And that's the piece that I think is the biggest rub for me. I don't love that we're in a context where we have to play those games. I don't understand that. And I don't know that I love that. I feel like it somehow feels less yogic, you know, and yet we're, I know everyone's doing their best. I don't doubt that for a second. There's too much rubbing. There's too much, too many pieces that don't feel aligned for me anymore. So I'm stepping away from the Yoga Alliance in its current incarnation and format.
This might be a short response, but specific to the Yoga Alliance, is there anything that the Yoga Alliance does that is valuable? And that's not to take away from the people who are working at the Yoga Alliance. I'm sure that it's filled with hardworking people who are yogis at heart. This is not to criticize the individuals of the Yoga Alliance, but they do have a massive influence and they take quite a bit of our money. So the organization is really what we're here to talk about. And let's start with Daniel. Anything valuable?
That's a good question. Yeah, I just thought probably the thing that they've offered is the idea that there can be standards, you know, so you could actually delineate categories within a training that, and then if you went further and actually had, you know, you could somehow measure those as in terms of the students' competence in those areas, which Yoga Alliance doesn't do, then that would be helpful. But just the idea that there's things you can measure like history and philosophy and anatomy, and you could parse these out into separate categories. I think that's valuable. That's my answer.
Thanks, Daniel. Mona.
Hi. I love that. And the fact that there were standards really was a big part of why I joined initially, because as somebody who came from the field of technology where there are standards, codes, like all that stuff, that appealed to that part of, to the pitta part of my mind really greatly. And another thing I think they do really, really well, and it's grown and expanded a lot in the past few years, is where they offer opportunities for their existing members to participate in, listen to webinars and all sorts of different informational opportunities. So folks can learn more about everything from philosophy, Bhagavad Gita, chakras, sequencing, alignment, biomechanics, anatomy. So they actually offer right now, it's like three or four a week, every single week. They have these different webinars that folks who are members are welcome to join free of charge. Well, free of charge on top of the membership fees that you have already paid to be a member. And I remember at one point, now this was a few years back, so the numbers could be different. I haven't looked into it lately. If somebody wanted to join a Yoga Alliance webinar, just one webinar, it was $75. And so to be a member and to, they were doing it once a month before COVID. So it was like a monthly, and I think they were working their way up to weekly, but it was offering people opportunities to get to know other teachers and to get more information in terms of content and yoga information, which I thought was really nice.
Thanks, Mo. Bree?
Mo, do they pay the teachers that they have doing the webinars? I'd be curious.
That's a great question that I cannot answer. They had put a request out for people who wanted to share information or wanted to offer a webinar. And I had wanted to offer one on the integration of yoga and Ayurveda, because the putting together of two separate sciences into one thing is there's a little bit more to it. And I was declined. They said there are other areas of far more interest to our membership. Oh, okay. But I have no idea if they actually pay the teachers or not. That's an awesome question.
Yeah. The cynical mind. Like, I hope they do. Because we're, Catherine, let me just ask quickly within that topic. Did you know or look in the research of this, like how much money that Yoga Alliance makes a year or something like this? Don't they? Is that
number? Yeah, oh, I don't have it handy, but I'm going to pull it up.
Okay. And then really my answer on this is short. Having never been an actual member of the Yoga Alliance, I can't honestly tell you any for good or bad. I don't know. But I do appreciate, Daniel, what you said with bringing, I hadn't looked at it that way. So thank you for that. They did create a guidelines, whether good, bad, right, or wrong. The fact that there are these guidelines and a perception of standards, you're right, is important. And it would be interesting. I just, for a moment when you were saying that, I was trying to envision a world without Yoga Alliance, and maybe where would we have gone? Maybe it would have actually been a little bit more of the Wild West. So yeah. So hooray. Chalk one or point one, 1.4 Yoga Alliance.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's largely how I view the Yoga Alliance, is at least they are an obstacle to the race to the bottom. It's not particularly optimistic. So that's my take on what the Yoga Alliance does that's valuable. And that's not to say that they aren't facilitating a number of conversations that are important in the yoga sphere, but something that comes up, but could probably come up more, is the money piece. Most people who are members of the Yoga Alliance are teacher trainers. That's where the most money is going into the Yoga Alliance. So to register a 200 and a 300 hour yoga program, particularly because of the exchange rate, it cost me over $2,000 to register two programs. And, you know, I don't want to give the impression that yogis are earning tons of money. I don't think that impression is out there. But just in case it was, we're not. And that amount for your annual dues has not changed because of COVID-19, right? As I'm watching my income vanish, my fees, my insurance, in fact, I got a reminder email from my insurance guy saying, just a reminder that if you teach online yoga, this is not covered by your policy and you will need to add a rider. So he's got our back. So frustrations with the Yoga Alliance, it tethers into our next question, because in our next question, we're going to evolve this a little bit to talk about the Canadian and the American yoga scene. But one of my greatest critiques of the Yoga Alliance is that they are not equitable. So I spend a lot of time at Kripalu in Massachusetts. I love Kripalu. Big fan. Want to see them keep running. Hope to see them in 2021. Love you, Kripalu. In 2015, the last year of financials that I could get my hands on, Kripalu earned over $3 million, I think it was $3.2 or $3.3 million US alone through their yoga school. Let that sink in, everyone. Kripalu and I pay the same Yoga Alliance fees. How is that fair? And so that's one of my many frustrations with Yoga Alliance. Now we are going to turn to the frustrations of Yoga Alliance, beginning with Mona, the recent divorcee of Yoga Alliance.
Recent divorcee. Nice. I think the part that I'm most challenged with, other than the whole people feeling like they're in a box and they have to play a game within the context and structure of it, is the sometimes people get grandfathered in and sometimes they don't. And I found that part actually really heartbreaking, that the more billboard well-known the yogi, the easier it was for them to get grandfathered in. And the more everyday Joe or Jane, like myself, the less likely they were to get grandfathered in. And that is offensive. It's beyond frustrating for me. It's just offensive. And I'd heard enough of the stories of that was part of, I had never questioned my affiliation with the Yoga Alliance until those stories started to creep into my world. And the first one, I was like, oh, that seems really odd. You know, we should call and talk to somebody about that. And then the third or the fourth one, I was like, what is happening? Now it's a pattern. Now it's a pattern. And it just feels icky.
You mean basically the higher the celebrity, the yoga teacher, the more they were then allowed to not, because currently what's required is if you do not have a Yoga Alliance certified training, even if you've been teaching for decades, if you want to offer Yoga Alliance certified trainings, you then have to go recertify. That's the rules. But the higher the celebrity status, the more it was like, it's okay, we'll just give it to you. Is that what you're saying?
So what I'm saying is, from what I can see, famous yoga people get to skip the line and not do the things, and non-famous, regular, everyday yoga teachers like me have to follow all the rules, tick all the boxes, even though my lack of fame also is likely a lack of resources to tick the boxes and do the things. And so that just feels icky to me. I don't like that. It frustrates me.
Thanks, Mo. Bree?
Again, not having ever been part of the Yoga Alliance, what I say is hearsay and conjecture is an outside perspective. So there's my disclaimer. It's interesting. It's interesting. I keep going back to the money and Catherine. Oh my goodness, that thing about Kripalu and the everyday teacher, holy, does that highlight so much. And it made me think about unionization, and it made me think about the intersection of that too, of, you know, like, I think what, from my outside perspective all these years, the Yoga Alliance has done a really good job of giving a public perception of, we're the regulating body, you know, we're governing this, we've got your back. Everything that's not part of Yoga Alliance isn't that great, but, you know, so we're going to take your money and we're going to offer you these monthly, as Mona said, these monthly things. And again, my question, are they sure great? And are they also even paying the teachers who are teaching that? And even if they are, I wish I could remember, like, I think it's millions and millions and millions. Like, I want to say, I'm making this up ish. Like, I think like $50 million a year or something that, I think the Yoga Alliance is a non, I make, again, please fact check what I'm saying. I'm going with like vague rumblings of the past of, I want to say, are they a nonprofit or are they a for-profit? So I think that's an important distinction to get clear on. Yeah, Catherine.
They are a nonprofit. And in 2017, and remember, this is in US dollars, which is like 80% more than Canadian. Just kidding. It's 35% more. 9.67 million in 2017.
So awesome for them and the nonprofitness. So, and I don't know enough about the nonprofit world to know what one does. If you're a nonprofit, where do these $9 million of profit go? So then that goes back to that sense of unionization and equity. And my assumption is, would that not go back to the people who are paying the dues? Catherine, you made a really great point about the pandemic. Wouldn't the Yoga Alliance ideally, oh crap, everything changed. We've got $9 million sitting in the bank because we're a nonprofit. So this apparently isn't going into anybody's pocket. Couldn't that go back to acknowledge the people who have been paying the dues over the years, give them a break in payments and slash the equity again of different like organizations from the small teacher to the bigger teacher? I think these are some really big things that are new to me to hear this. So if they're new to me and I feel like I've got my finger on the yoga world pulse somewhat, then what about the average teacher who's like, I need to do a yoga teacher training and I need to have it as a 200 hour. And they don't know the deeper layers of this. So I think one of my issues with the Yoga Alliance that's getting even more refined in our conversation, thank you everybody, is the public perception that they give. I don't know about their marketing team. They've done a fabulous job of giving the perception that Yoga Alliance is a governing body, the gamification of like, if I want to have a successful teacher training, I better play the game of being part of Yoga Alliance, even though I don't want to, because I perceive that the students don't want that. And so it's like this whole juggernaut of power and money that I don't think a lot of people are actually understanding and questioning. So that's a big one. Lots of big stuff within that.
Yeah. Thanks, Bree. Daniel?
Yeah, thanks. I think your point about the Kripalu cost to play the game versus the individual is absolutely your strongest point, Catherine, for any kind of an argument against them. It's just, it's kind of shocking when you look at it that way. And it makes me want to get everybody in Canada just together and have one yoga school and register it with Yoga Alliance in different locations. We can all spend about $12 per year. But I think in terms of like now to sort of, now that we've given the devil his due and sort of said what's good about Yoga Alliance, I mean, you know, I think it's really impossible for them to do the job that they pretended to set out to do, which we've been mentioning, which is to really try to govern what's going on with yoga, again, because of these basic difficulties of defining what yoga is. I will say this, though, that no matter what organization, let's say Yoga Alliance folds tomorrow and says, you know, out of a moment of clarity, they say, you know, we're just not doing a good job here. We're going to give everybody back their dues this year. We're going to close the whole thing down. That leaves the field open for another thing, Yoga Alliance-ish kind of a thing to come up and try to do the same job again. And that organization, as it grows, just like Yoga Alliance has done, will eventually grow more and more, and more of the resources will be sent towards keeping that institution existing. So it's just sort of exists to serve itself. This is what, as far as I can tell, all institutions end up doing. So we... even though if we tear it down, we build it back up, whatever is built next would have to be, the structure of building the next thing would have to be understood right away. How can we avoid what happened to Yoga Alliance? In what way can we incentivize that not happening? Human beings behaving as they do and getting salaries and wanting to continue work, it's very difficult to do that. So that's the big question for me, is like if it gets torn down, which it maybe very well should be, whatever is going to come up next is going to have to be really, really looked at carefully. So that's what I have.
Which, you know, that question is on the list. And I've actually tried to talk a number of young yogis into starting an alternative organization. I just don't have the time. So my hope is that this podcast and some actions thereafter prompt some change in the Yoga Alliance. And if it doesn't, that someone listens to this and takes my business idea, I'll offer free mentoring. So again, one of the reasons I mention individuals at the Yoga Alliance is that I think the individuals at the Yoga Alliance with whom I've been in conversation in preparation for two years, I've been emailing them in preparation for this conversation. You know, I think they would listen to a lot of what we had to say and say, but that's not our intention. That's not the work that we're doing. But there's a lot of conversation right now about the difference between intention and impact and the culture that gets shaped and what role do big players have, even if it's not their intention, what culture have they shaped through their inaction? And Daniel, you brought up a great point, which is that, you know, do we really want yoga regulation? Do we really want to be told what makes a good training, what doesn't make a good training, how many hours, et cetera? But what ends up happening, and I, before we move on, I'm more than happy to have other people jump into this. What ends up happening is that because the yoga industry is a hard industry, it was a hard industry before this pandemic. And so what ends up happening is distinctly un-yogic. People market based on difference. Here's how I'm different. Here's how my training is different. And so then we end up marketing typically uses fear or anger to motivate people. Distinctly not yogic, not to say that we don't have difficult feelings, but intentions of cultivating fear, definitely not yogic. And so that's what ends up happening in the yoga community is, oh, that training might not be Yoga Alliance certified. Don't know about that one. So Yoga Alliance becomes this tool of cultivating fear, and studios and teacher trainers watch each other and police each other, you know, and cultivate this sense of separateness, this sense of adhering to rules, even though every time it rolls around to them paying their Yoga Alliance dues, they have to sit back and reflect, what has the Yoga Alliance really done for me this year? Bree?
I would love to, on a side note of optimism, and in terms of that, from my little corner of the world, having run teacher trainings for a number of years without Yoga Alliance, I want to offer to me, from what I can see, there's more and more teachers and schools who are saying no. From my perception, I know there's different pockets around the world, and maybe in the US where maybe there's yoga communities where it's like, it's so tied into Yoga Alliance, you can't get a job without teaching in Yoga Alliance. So I recognize that. But I think from my perception, it's changing, and I've seen myself included a lot more bold teachers who are willing to actually, and I publicly talk about it. So I don't just say, I publicly talk about it because I'm tired of all the emails going, are you Yoga Alliance? So it's on our FAQ page. And then I've made every year that I've run my most recent teacher training, I do a public post on Instagram and whatnot. And it gets about just very, you know, hopefully loving and kind, objective-ish reasons why we're not doing Yoga Alliance. And the amount of people that reply in that comment stream, it's huge. And so from what I can see in my corner of the world, there is a little bit of a sea change happening where there's more and more people who are like Mona, as I like the newest divorcee is of Yoga Alliance, is kind of stepping away from that. And I think there is a certain beautiful movement within that. So if anybody's listening to this and they're on that fence and they're resonating with some of what we say, you're not alone in... If you say no, there's more and more people who are doing that. And I think then that gives a new sort of movement and credence to not having to play that game and to buy into that fear. I just wanted to point that little optimistic moment out.
Love the optimism. Thanks, Bree. Mo.
Can I circle back to something Daniel said? So as he was sharing, he talked about what happens if the Yoga Alliance, you know, goes down and what is going to grow up in its stead. And one of the pieces I'm aware of is that governments love to regulate things. And one of the things that scares the shit out of me is bureaucrats coming up with what the yoga people should be doing who know nothing about yoga, which is why I registered my teacher training with Human Resources and Skills Development Canada, because I wanted my name and a government file somewhere that said, this lady knows something about yoga, enough of something that we're going to accredit her school as a private educational institution. We're even going to let CRA go tax exempt on that program, because we're going to treat it like a university or a college program, so that should the government decide someday that they are suddenly interested in yoga. And I'm trying to do the same thing for Ayurveda, because should they get interested in Ayurveda, I would like an Ayurveda person to have a voice, just like I think if the regulators are going to become our government institutions, which in the States we're seeing that. So I've spent a lot of time studying in the States, and a lot of my teachers are American, and it's been really interesting to see how this state has said, this is the standard for yoga. And if you want to teach a yoga class, this is the amount of training that you need to have. And I know Australia has done the same thing. So if you know, there's all these different areas where this is coming up. And I had always hoped that at least if the yoga at the time, that if the Yoga Alliance's voice was loud enough, they would be a place where governments could look to actually see what are yoga people doing. Because yeah. Nothing scares me more than non-yogis, government non-yogis, creating the legislation to govern yoga as an industry. That scares me.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I added this in your, when you posted your FAQ as to why you were not going to be part of Yoga Alliance, not unlike Breeze, I added a couple of Q&As to it. One of them was, you know, is there a precedent for an industry, for a Canadian industry to be regulated by an American body? And there is not. Couldn't find one. So that's what we're going to move to in a second. However, we also talked about why isn't yoga regulated? And yoga, my take, yoga largely is not regulated because it is too hard to earn a full-time income from teaching yoga. If it were easy or even moderately hard to earn a full-time income from teaching yoga, I firmly believe there would be a regulatory body in Canada. The colleges would have tried to take it over. We'd all be employees of, you know, various levels of college and university. But I think that's why it's not regulated. The dollars just don't add up. Everyone should teach yoga, by the way. Teaching yoga is amazing. I do it part-time.
Well, and I this is the thing, is because we're in the industry, we have a different perception. But when you look at the wheel that is Yogaland, it's a multi-billion dollar industry when you include the pants and the socks and the sacral chakra underwear and the headbands and the 17 array of mat, because you need a different mat depending on which nakshatra is prominent in your chart of the various months, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it is a multi-billion dollar industry, which is why I think governments are always looking at what is it, that, which wheels are turning and which cogs are they turning in. It just so happens our part isn't the multi-billion dollar part.
It's true. We really should have gone into pants. So much money in pants.
Send me a link for that sacral chakra underwear. I have my money ready.
All right. So this one, and I'm going to give a little context for this question because I put it in our questions, but didn't really offer much of a vision. So as I mentioned, you know, we've now established that Yoga Alliance earns $9.67 million annually. When I started doing this podcast, I really wanted to have on Canadian yoga teachers. And that's largely because probably everyone, you know, at this virtual table has probably done some training with an American teacher. I don't know that most of my American yoga friends could say the same. Now, I do think the yoga landscape is changing. I think it's likely increasingly hard to be a traveling yoga celebrity. People increasingly want to train with their local people and do workshops with their local people. So that's not to say that we're rabidly celebrity trained, but I think purely being Canadian, you can't not see that there is a difference between Canadian and American cultures, period. But we're a tenth the size of America. We're spread out over a massive geography. We also don't have the litigious culture that Americans have. We're dramatically less fear-based, possibly because we have social healthcare. And I also think that the Canadian yoga scene is smaller, right? We're more homegrown. We have fewer celebrities. I don't think that's because we don't have awesome people with lots to share. But I contacted the Yoga Alliance and I've been chasing them for 2 years trying to get some information on the numbers. And what I ended up finding out was that the percent of teachers in Canada out of all Yoga Alliance teachers is almost 6%. So it's just over 6,000 accounts. the percent of schools in Canada out of all Yoga Alliance schools is almost 6%. So it's 427 schools. So annually, Canadian yogis, of that 9.67 million that they gathered in 2017, annually, if we're doing a low end of estimates, remembering that everyone pays an initial fee and then an annual fee, Canadian yogis are sending almost $500,000, just shy of like $1,000 to Yoga Alliance every year. And that's in US dollars. We're sending $500,000 American dollars to them. And in 2 years, they have not been able to tell me how much is coming back into Canada. They can't say if there's a scholarship coming this way, if there was COVID support coming this way, if they've hired Canadians. They don't have a sole person on the market. It's not an unreasonable request to say that Canada has a person at the Yoga Alliance representing our interests, and preferably someone who's Canadian. So that's my soapbox. I've touched on a few things. So here's the conversation. Is there a distinct Canadian yoga scene? Have I dreamt this up? And how do you see the relationship between American and Canadian yoga communities and as it relates to Yoga Alliance? Being our most international teacher, we're going to start with Bree.
I laugh. It's interesting. And yeah, I think it's interesting having, again, like starting to practice yoga in 99 and then started teaching in 2003. And I've lived all over Canada and kind of taught all over Canada. And then, yeah, over the last number of years have been moving my teaching online and internationally. And so, yeah, so I kind of have an interesting view of it, I guess, of just seeing how the yoga world has grown over the years. And then just, yeah, I don't know. Is there a yoga scene in Canada? Yes. One of the first thing, is it similar to the United States? No. And one of the first things that I think about is look at the movie industry or entertainment compared to Canada and the US. The US is this juggernaut everywhere in that sense. And so, and then there's like the little Canadian movie industry. Like it's, and I think it's just very representative here too in the yoga world. It's like you've got all, I don't know, very little yoga celebrities in the same context as we see from the Yoga Journal and those days of yoga teachers on. They're all from the US. And of course, think about this. They're also mostly from what I can tell, a lot of that. I feel like the age of the yoga celebrity is dying. Maybe that's my optimism. But so I'm thinking, like, you know, in the last 10 years or so, when it really started to blow up, maybe even 15 years ago, of the Yoga Journal covers and the yoga headliners of Wanderlust and stuff like that, most of those yoga celebrities were also West Coast, East Coast, right? Mm-hmm. West Coast, US, East Coast. Were there a lot of Midwestern popularized yoga teachers? So there's even that same pattern in the US as it is here, let alone how many famous European yoga teachers are there. I'm sure we could maybe name off a couple. So the culture that we live in outside of yoga influences our yoga. And we see those similarities. So of course, with the US being the US, no wonder we've seen so many more popular teachers. And yeah, and slash with the Canada, maybe it's true. We are really spread out and we are really regionally focused and specific. So for me, I've lived kind of in the mountains, and I've lived in Edmonton. I'm currently living in Vancouver Island. And so for me, I've usually been in the West mostly. I get invited over the years. I teach a very niche approach to yoga in a way, with applied anatomy. So I've been able to grow my name outside of Canada. I'm probably known more outside of Canada than I am in Canada. You know, getting invited.
Are you very big in Denmark?
Yeah, very big in, exactly. So it's just I find that fascinating. In fact, I'm probably, this just sounds so ridiculous, but people might know me more in the UK than they do in Canada. And it's just when you have that niche, and I don't know. Why is that? Is that because the niche, this more applied, sustainable approach to yoga, why wouldn't that be as big as it is in other places here in Canada? I don't know. I actually don't know. This is as I'm kind of verbally processing this now, going, wait a second. I don't know. And it's interesting. And is that our culture? Do we tend to be like this? And maybe people in other countries are open to learning from other teachers. Our online teacher training actually has a higher per registrants of Americans than people from the UK, Europe, and then Canadians. So it's an interesting, I don't know. Yeah. So I guess I got this. I don't know. Actually, I'm sorry. I don't have anything clear on this. It was a good verbal processing exploration of, that's our world. It's interesting. Yeah. The Canadian yoga scene is, I don't think I could even name that many famous yoga teachers from Canada in the same level of what we perceive some of the other ones in the US. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why.
Okay. Thanks, Bree. Big in Denmark. Daniel?
Yeah, it is a good question. And just listening to Bree go through that is actually quite helpful. I guess the short answer is probably no. Yoga, if you think about it, is a very introverted practice. If you're not in a public class, if you're actually doing your own practice, it is introverted. You're looking into your own nature, the way your own body works. So there's sort of an individualistic, on one level, approach to the practice. And then if you look at styles of yoga, then people can get attached to Ashtanga, Anusara yoga when it was around, Kripalu, whatever it is. So I think you'll probably see more subcultures attached to teachers or styles of yoga than you will geographically. Having said that, I mean, Bree mentioned this too, I think the coasts and large city centers have always been responsible for producing more yoga studios and a more vibrant yoga scene, because I think you need a critical mass of people to make that happen, right? You see nice cafes popping up in gentrified areas of cities, and you can almost bet there's going to be a yoga studio nearby. So these things kind of go together like bees and flowers. So I don't think Canada has its own style of yoga or its own scene, but I think there is definitely, as you mentioned when you were teaching those people, Catherine, in the States, there's definitely a Canadian feel to what we do, and it is different than America. We're probably a little less individualistic, a little bit more trusting of our government, maybe a little bit less handy with guns and things like that. And that doesn't seem to make any clear line between the two, but I think the psychology of a Canadian is different. But yeah, I guess my short answer, having taught in Shanghai and in Japan a fair bit, I would say that as North Americans, we're probably, to those, to the rest of the world, we're probably more similar than we are different, even America and Canada.
Good point. Thanks, Daniel. Mo?
I love that you just said that, Daniel. When I went to India, it was a long time ago now, they kept saying, "You are American." And I was like, "Oh no, I'm Canadian." And they were like, "Yeah, American." And I was like, "Oh no, I'm Canadian." And so it's, in my mind, there's this distinction, but in their mind, there was not. Yeah. In terms of a distinct Canadian yoga scene, yeah, I don't know. I only know like my own little corner of the world, my own little corners of the world, right? So I know Yogaland Boston quite well, because I've spent a lot of time there. And I know, you know, Yogaland Kingston and Yogaland Ottawa well. And that's about it, because that's where my yoga's happened. That's where my life has been. I know Kripalu, because I basically have an on-demand room there. And so I know these little pockets, but I don't know the rest. I do feel, though, that culturally Americans and Canadians are different. I've always felt that in my time spent in the States. And then if I have American friends coming here, we talk about how there are parts that are similar and yet how there are parts that feel very, very different, especially when you're there and when you're in it. And so I think that the cultures are distinct. And I think one of the blessings of sharing a geographic border is we get to have overlap. We get to have overlap. And so as much as that means we get access to some really great American teachers, I think what people are learning now is they also have access to some really great Canadian teachers. And even if Yogaland famous Canada looks and feels very different than Yogaland famous USA, I agree with you, Catherine. I think we have as much talent and as much yoga brilliance here in Canada as there is anywhere. And so I think the potential for brilliance exists everywhere. And I think where people are really sincere and dedicated and wholehearted, I think that brilliance can come through. So I think there's probably as much Yogaland Australia brilliance, Yogaland UK brilliance, right? Yogaland everywhere brilliance. And it's simply interesting to me that yoga itself isn't quite, I don't know if this is the right language for it, that yoga itself isn't interconnected enough for people to recognize and be able to see all the different levels and layers of brilliance. So where there are some folks that are so brilliant, and if you were to say, hey, have you taken a class with so-and-so, people would be like, I have no idea who you're talking about. So that's also really interesting. But I think some people might even prefer that. I know for me personally, fame scares the effing shit out of me. Scares the daylights out of me. I think it would do a number on my pitta, and I think I could make quite an ass of myself. And so I have very little interest in being in testing that. Yeah. Not that I should be famous or that I would be famous, but if I were famous, I could probably be a pretty big jerk ball. And so I'm, yeah, fame
you
scares me.
You should be, but Mona's first yoga bio photo, just so everyone knows, was her in Karna Padasana. And if anyone doesn't remember what Karna Padasana looks like, imagine plow pose, except hugging your head with your ears and then a side photo. So you couldn't see her face, but if you saw her bum like stretched out, you'd be like, Mona. So
I was saying that about being an ass.
I bring up that question because I do think that the Yoga Alliance has an obligation to consider a market that sends a lot of money to them. I think that they do have an obligation to consider that market individually. But I also think that they don't realize that being American, this whole conversation about risk management is very different than how we perceive it here. Because if we regulate yoga to minimize risk, and in America, the perception of risk is far higher than it is in Canada, again, social health care, you need to take that into account, or at least Canadians need to take that into account when they think about, am I going to join the Yoga Alliance or not? Not to say that we ever want our students to need health care after our classes.
Well, can I jump in about that question around insurance too? Because this is another one that comes up. So again, there's perception. It's sort of on task within this, but I think this is another one of these myths that need to come up with the Yoga Alliance, is that I have a lot of people who think, oh, well, I need a Yoga Alliance or else I can't get insured. And that's absolutely not true. And I know this in the US, in Canada, and in the UK, and in Australia, I believe, and probably in Europe as well. In fact, my most recent updated insurance that I got, I went to a different carrier because they do great prices for online here in Canada and for online teaching. And I don't think I just filled an online form. I don't think they even looked at my certification, because actually I would have had to go into some box I haven't unearthed in about 18 years to like pull out that piece of paper from 2003. So they didn't even they didn't care what organization I was from. They're like, oh, you teach yoga? Sure, whatever. Send us your money. Boom, we've got you covered with insurance. So that risk mitigation, that impression that Yoga Alliance perceives, like, and you'll get a good deal on insurance, you have, or you can't be insured without it. That's completely untrue.
Yeah. And the insurer in Canada who is affiliated with Yoga Alliance, so they have some business relationship where they get to offer this insurance. I hounded them one year and said, how many claims have you had? And they said that they had, in Canada, had two claims through their program. And I followed up the next year and said, has that changed? And then the next year they wouldn't give me the number. So I guess I was less persuasive the second time around. I'm cognizant of the time. And so I'm going to roll the last question into two. And so we'll stick with Daniel first, but rolling it into one question, Daniel, do you have specific ideas for Yoga Alliance and how they could evolve to better meet the yoga community's needs? And do you have a vision for alternatives?
Great. I think the way Yoga Alliance is built, there isn't really a way for them to pivot, and they would have to restructure fundamentally in order to do that. In order to serve the needs of what we've been talking about, which is actually real governance, they'd have to restructure everything. I just don't think they could do it, and I don't think there's any motivation for them to do it. They have a niche that's been working for them, that's evolved in a business world, you know, because it's commerce. And so I really don't think that's going to change. What'll happen is that if, you know, with this new thing that's happened to the culture with COVID and the necessity for Yoga Alliance being maybe less important, and I talked to them personally a little while ago too, and when I was registering again and just asking her a few questions, the receptionist, and it was quite clear from the tone that they're just very happy to get the registration money. It's like someone else said here earlier, that suddenly I think it was Mona said, that it was very difficult to get online programs happening, and suddenly everything's online. And the motivation is obvious there for all of us. So I don't think Yoga Alliance is going to change. And in terms of something new, coming to replace it, that's always an incredibly difficult question. I think you just have to look worldwide at other industries and say, are there other regulated industries that in which the regulation is working really well? And, you know, things that come to mind for me are things like the trades. Like if you look at, say, if you want to hire an electrician or a plumber, because those things are so, it's so clear what the scope of practice is for a plumber. And the schooling and the certification is very clear. When you hire a certified, if there's such a thing, certified plumber, you kind of know what you're getting because it's so constrained, right? What plumbing is so constrained. So this would have to happen definitionally to yoga as a practice, as a physical practice. And I know that leaves a lot out of yoga, but in terms of being able to teach it, I think you'd have to do that first. And then that organization would have to be designed to incentivize independence in teaching and not to incentivize the growth of the organization.
Mm. Thank you, Daniel. Mona.
That was so well put, Daniel. Thank you. Thank you so much. I agree that the Yoga Alliance is in a tough position to shift what they do and how they do it. And I think what I'd like to see, whether it's through Yoga Alliance or some new something that arises, is something a little more conversational, collaborative. I was reading through Gary Kissa's new, I think it's called Light on Law is what he's called it, where he does a lot as a lawyer, he does a lot of writing about waivers and liability and the whole legal aspect of studio ownership and being a yoga teacher and all that kind of stuff. And when I first opened the school, I got his first huge book. It was very, very big. And I read through that. And then he's created an amendment given the COVID pandemic. And so different ways of wording around liability for people who are doing live classes as well as online. So different ways of changing and adapting the waivers. And one of the things he mentions in the book that really stood out to me, and Catherine, it reminds me of some conversations we've had in the past, is this idea that should something go awry within a yoga studio, it's important that there be a board where people can express can make their claim, whether it's, you know, this didn't happen to my liking, this was inappropriate, et cetera, et cetera. And then a whole conversation can be facilitated around that. And I think in my heart, I kind of hoped that that's what the Yoga Alliance was going to be. I just didn't have a language or an idea around that way back when I joined 16 years ago. And so now that I know what I know, I think that's something I'd be more interested in, where when issues arise of all sorts in yoga land, that there would be somewhere that we could go to collaborate and discuss and try to find ways to improve, try to find ways to reconcile, try to find ways to bring more yoga into yoga land, in essence, so that we can keep, because we're going to learn as we do, because that's how it works. And I think there's room for more learning and more doing, but people are either people are either hiding what they're doing or they're afraid to talk about where things have gone wrong for fear of all this judgment and reprimand and more separation. You're going to be even more excluded from the group of Yoga Land because you've done X, Y, Z. And so I think if something like that were to arise, I would be very interested in exploring that.
Cool. Thanks, Mona. Bree.
Yeah, to touch on both of those wonderful points from you both, I think, again, where I said earlier about the culture that we're in, yoga is not excluded from that. And so the culture that we're in are basically the capitalistic, patriarchal, colonized systems of oppression, you know, and this stuff shows up in yoga and the way that yoga has been taught, the hierarchies, and especially the commodification of yoga. As Catherine said earlier, it's this couple billion dollar industry. I don't even know the numbers anymore. And when there's money to be had, money is power. And it's hard to let go of that and bring it back to the people teaching it, the people offering it. And so this is very hopefully magical and one day happens. But I think what we would need to do an organization, I would love to see something that's decommodified, that's decolonized, that's more unionized, that's more for the people, where if there, whatever money that gets put in, it's put back to the people. And again, and I go back to Catherine's point with the Kripalu, with just that shared equity, more opportunities for people who don't have the opportunity to teach, to spend $3,000, $5,000 on a teacher training, you know, spreading that out and having a code of ethics, and an ever-changeable communal code of ethics that we intersectionally look at, right? Not just us four white teachers having this conversation, but, you know, may this be something where more voices are also heard and seen and taken to account, because aren't these the principles of yoga? And so as Mona was saying, right, like this is like, let's bring the yoga into this. And it's not just like, okay, so peace and love. And now we just got to all, you know, but it's like, let's put the freaking yoga into practice in that. And looking at that, I don't know, so I think some of the keywords would be like collaborative, as Mona was saying, democratized, unionized, decolonized, equitable, work and yet still with a boundary of scope of practice, a boundary of code of ethics, a boundary of a governing board that because look at all the misuse of power that we've had over the years of yoga in many ways. But first, let's just talk about male teachers. Where does that go? Where did those guys answer to? You know, where did Bikram answer to? I guess the law-ish. But where did those teachers who brought those allegations out and had experienced that? Where's that code of ethics? Did the Yoga Alliance do anything? I don't know. That's a rhetorical question. I don't
think. Oh, yeah, of course. They do. They have, you know, and this is, Bree, I think you raise a really excellent point, is that, so they did specifically address sexual harassment in a sort of breakout code of ethics. So if you go to their website, I'm pretty sure that there's like specifically sexual harassment and complaints.
Good. Who takes care of that? Like, is that part of the $9 million profit that they have that goes, or maybe it's not even profit, but revenue. So obviously that would go into salaries. And does that revenue then go also into a follow through on that? So if I had an allegation from a male teacher, or like towards a male teacher, and I want to go to Yoga Lands because I paid my dues to them, right? Like, these are, again, I don't have answers. Hopefully somebody does. And that follow through, it's just, you know, when we can take the commodification away, and even nonprofit is still profit. And I think we can use yoga to create maybe a microcosm, this is me getting really optimistic, but really a microcosm of what I personally would love to see in the world and how governance can be.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you. And I think you also, you know, the point that you raised is that Yoga Alliance has created this element of a code of ethics specific to this potential, you know, beginning at indiscretion, ending at crime, potential in the yoga community. However, I don't think anyone's turning to the Yoga Alliance first and foremost for help. I'm not. You know, I'm turning to my peers. I'm turning to Mona. I'm turning to other people who are in this milieu with me. But I also think that when that becomes the only focus of yoga ethics, we have a real problem. Like, does the buck stop with like, don't touch your students? And then everything else is okay. You know, Bree, you raised a lot of excellent points about like, what does ethical yoga business look like? Which I think is a whole other podcast.
That's a whole other, exactly. Five more hours and we can, yeah. And that's big and it's important. I think these are the things to consider. And so in a way for me, I'm like this little outsider here with my yoga school that I've been, it's not even a yoga school. It's just like, I'm offering yoga teacher trainings. And for me, in a way, I'm like, I'm proudly, happily not part of Yoga Alliance because then I get to have my own code of ethics and I trust my integrity and my intuition and offering and teaching that to teachers. But I can't be so Pollyanna optimistic that everybody else is going to be like that too. So I think there is definitely what we're, as we kind of summarize what this whole long conversation, an important conversation is, there is a need for a boundary. I think this is what we're talking about. In my words here would be, is it whatever the organization, and I think Daniel, you said something about like organizations before that I thought was very apt about just once they become an organization, it's a little, you know, so it's like, how do we even, I think we need to tear down and restructure what an organization can be. And again, not basing it on what the world is right now, because as we all know, it's all going to hell in a handbasket and we don't need to recreate the wheel. And so may the yogis rise up and show a different kind of way of governance and organization, because we do need those boundaries. We do. Mm-hmm. We need it. Obviously, doing what we were doing before isn't the way it's going to solve. Let's please God not recreate the wheel. And somebody else do it. I'm really tired. So,
yeah. So my
support.
My vision, what I really want someone to do, I really want someone to create an association that is more than a registry. Because there's lots of them out there and I can't see that they're doing much more than any of the other ones, often less. I would love for people to create an association where the whole premise of joining is cultivating teacher and community integrity. And so your education program doesn't have to be 200 hours, but you do have to be able to justify why it's as long as it is, what is in it. You have to be able to, just like a thesis defense, here is why it is this way. And then each member would have their own board of directors. You three can all join mine. And then if someone had a complaint, as maybe a customer, if that's how we view some of our yoga students, because that's often what it is. But whether it's a question of finances or impropriety or concern about expectations not being met, that they had clearly identifiable people that they could go to say, you know, I need some mediation. I need some help. I need this person to be able to hear me. And I think I need some help doing that. So that's my vision. Someone please take it.
Accountability. I think that's the word. That's just kind of makes me wonder, again, using that abuse of power historically for a lot of, not all male yoga teachers, even close, but you know, we have countless examples of that. Would that happen a little bit less if we knew there was going to be accountability, that there was somewhere that things would get enforced other than the law?
Yeah.
Because you're right. If we wait that long. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Matthew Remsky can't go after everybody. Anything to add in closing?
It was a great conversation. Everybody, thank you.
Thank you so, so much, everyone. I so appreciate you taking the time. It's not a time where most of us have nothing to do and no other worries. I really appreciate it. Thanks for your wisdom.
Well, thanks for having us. And thanks to everybody listening to this too. I hope it gives us everyone good food for thought and more questions. I hope this leaves us all with more questions than answers, and maybe us like heading towards a new vision as well. Just, and we co-create it, right? Like, God darn it. We don't need more celebrity yoga teachers. This is a collective future now.
Thank you so much, everyone. Bye for now.
Bye.
That's all for this week, yogis. Let me know if you have any thoughts to share with me on this topic or any other. And remember that you can join Mona and I for a Chair Yoga for Seniors online training beginning September 30th. Details at www.intelligentedge.yoga. Bye for now.